to understand the impact of residential school on me, you had to know where I came from. I was born on Six Nations in Oswegan to a Mohawk dad and a non-Native mother. And we had a very happy life. Our mother had 14 kids. I know. I always said, didn't they have anything else to do back then? But maybe they didn't, I don't know. But anyway, so she was married twice. So I have seven in the older half of our family, and there's seven in the younger half. And we had a very wonderful life. We played outside all the time. We didn't have any running water. We didn't have electricity. But it was simple, but it was really nice. It was really a good life. And our mother raised chickens, so we had lots of food. She did canning, baked all the time. We sat down at a table with mom and dad and, you know, just like a regular family. And then one day our father passed away. And so our mother was left on the reserve to fend for herself with all of us kids. And I think she lasted about a good year and a half before she had a nervous breakdown. She wasn't treated very well, I'll have to tell you that. It was very violent after our father died in our home. And I can see why she had a nervous breakdown. Anyway, so our oldest sister on the other half, she tried to take care of us, but she was having her own family. She had gotten married and she had little kids too. So she put us in the residential school that you see behind us in 1957. And so we all went in there, my older sister, my older brother, and my four younger ones. Had gone all gone there. But I think part of the other impact was, like, because our family, our dad and mom never smacked us, never yelled at us. If we did something wrong, well, they just talked to us. Like my older brother, he was my best pal. His name was Garfield. And he used to take me through the woods. We'd swing on the vines. If I was six, he would have been seven at the time. But we were allowed to just roam around anywhere. Mind you, one time we got chased by pigs. That wasn't fun. But we would do all of those things. He'd make a bow and arrow for me. Never worked. And we just had such a wonderful life. And at home, we all often slept in the same bed. I think we just had, I used to say two rooms, but it wasn't really rooms. On one side was the kitchen, and the other side was the beds. And that was our life. And so we all slept, a lot of us would sleep in the same bed. So in 1957, we all went to the residential school, which I will refer to as the mush hole, because when I arrived, that's what it was called, and it had been called that for years. And I think it was because in the Depression times, they often had porridge a couple times, maybe three times a day in that residential school. So it got the nickname mush hole. Anyway, so my sister, Rob, her name's Roberta. I always call her Rob. I don't know how the two of us were always together, but we were in a certain way. So one night, or the very first night that I remember of going into the big dorm, it was kind of late at night. It was really dark and everything. And we were supposed to call them house mothers. There was nothing motherly about them. I always call them officers. Brought us into the dorm on the second floor there and said to me, you sleep there, and my little sister, you sleep over there. So we crawled into bed. But my little sister, she said she was scared. I told her, come sleep with me, because that was normal. That was normal in our house. Nobody ever had to really fend for themselves because we all crawled into the same bed. And so the officer comes back a little while later, and she says to three little ones on the other side, I heard you talking. Get down here. And they start to cry. Well, what are they crying for? If they were talking, what's the harm in that? Nobody told us we shouldn't. And then she turns and looks at myself and my sister Roberta and says, what are you two doing in the same bed? Get out here. in that stern voice. And like, we weren't used to that either. But we knew that we were in trouble if those three little ones from the other side were crying. Whatever was going to happen to them was probably going to happen to us. And it did. The officer had a great big long, I called it an industrial belt. It was really thick and really hard. And so you had to hold out your hands and get the strap three times on each side. And of course, by the time you get strapped, you've got a welt that comes from here to here. And your hands are like a sore. It's all swollen up. And of course, you cry because you've never been, I would call that abuse. Anyway, so we learned. Most of the things that we learned there, we learned by trial and error, what we weren't supposed to do after the fact. So we learned that we weren't supposed to talk. We weren't supposed to get out of bed. There was something else that we were supposed to learn that time. But we knew we couldn't talk anymore, or if you did, you're going to get the strap. And I have to tell you, I got the strap frequently. I couldn't be quiet. Or there was a few other things I did too. You know, like you see pipes running across here. Well, they had them in the dorms. There was nothing else to do sometimes. Like when I was little, I couldn't get up there. But as I got older, like maybe 8 or 9, I migrated to the top bunk. Then I could jump up on those pipes and swing across the room. Everybody did it. It was our only entertainment. It was great until you got caught. So one day, or one night rather, my bed was over there at the top. I was over there swinging along, having fun, and the officer came in. Of course, I knew I was in trouble because I'm over there. So I had to swing all the way back, drop down on my bed, and I knew I was going to get the strap. Do you think it deterred me? Nope. Maybe about a week or two, and then I was back up there again. But there was nothing else to do. And we got a little smarter by then, because most of the girls did that, and we posted somebody at the door. Smart. Anyway, so when everybody said she was coming, we'd all just kind of get back to our beds, and I know that one time I didn't quite make it, but I dropped down on somebody else's bed, and she didn't check all the beds that night. She just kind of looked around, didn't see anybody swinging. Everybody looked to be in their beds, so she went out, and that was the end of that. And so that was kind of our life in the dorms. You went to bed real early. You weren't supposed to talk. You weren't supposed to get out of bed. But most of us did. Anyway, so that was part of the routine. The other part was that we were given a number when we arrived. I'm number 54. I still use that number on my secret codes and everything else. But none of you know who I am, so it doesn't matter. Anyway. So I was 54. My sister Rob was 34. And you never forget those numbers because they didn't call you by your name. Nobody said, "Dawn, come here." It was number 54. Get down here. And so we all knew who we were, number 54. But amongst ourselves, we didn't call each other by our numbers. We got to know all the kids. Like there must have been like 60 kids. So we got to know everybody there and where they came from, how they got there, their personalities, who to stay away from, because there were bullies. In any environment, there will be bullies. So when we were just little, my first kind of introduction to that I remember about the playroom, which was down on the first floor, was being pushed into another little girl. Two girls right here. They would put you in a circle. Somebody would push you from one side, those older girls, and on the other side, they'd push the other girl into you and told you had to fight. I wasn't brought up to fight, but I knew they weren't going to let me out of that ring of girls, and that tells you nobody was watching us. They would keep pushing until you did fight, and you knew you had to. So I got the little girl down, and I punched her in the face. I figured I'd won. I got back up. Well, that wasn't the end of it, apparently, because she got me down, and she didn't really let up on the punching me in the face. And I don't really remember how that ended, other than maybe an officer came in or one of the older girls decided to have mercy on me. I don't know, or the little girl maybe just let quit. I don't know. We saw that happen frequently. And I know that they beat up one of the little bit older girls than we were, because she used to hang around with the three top bullies in the playroom. And one day, I guess, I don't know whether they were bored or what, they took her into this. We had a little area. We called it the cloakroom, and it had like little boxes in it and whatever. But we could hear her being bounced off the wall and screaming and crying and whatever. And so I think somebody must have ran to get the officer again. Nobody was watching, or it would have never happened. Anyway, so she, Miss Tawn, I think, came in, and they were coming out of that cloakroom, and that girl had a big swollen eye, and her lip was cut, and she had a bloody nose, and they took her to, the hospital, and those three older girls were sent to reform school. Now, I could see why they would be sent, because of that bullying attitude that they had, but there's always some others that kind of step up to that position of, I can control you kids, but they were never as bad as those three that were there when we first got there. So most of the time we didn't really have things to play with. I mean, sometimes people would go home on the weekends, their parents would come and get them, and they would bring back jacks or a skipping rope or a ball, and that was okay until it, you know, got damaged or stolen or whatever. And most of the time we made up our own activities. So that was kind of like how life was. We lined up to go to our meals in order. And when you got to the dining room, the girls sat on one side and the boys sat on the other side. And that's the only time I really had a chance to see that older brother that I really used to chum around with at home. And if I'd saw him way over there, I'd go like this and I'd wave at him. And he'd wave back, but I never got to talk to him anymore. And one day he was just gone. Nobody told us where he went. I had no idea. And it was like, I think we were teenagers before I finally found out what happened to him. And my three younger ones were taken to a foster home on the reserve. A friend of our father's, he said, I couldn't take all of you, so I took the three little ones. And it's when we were teenagers, he sent us a bus ticket to come home and meet the rest of our family. So by that time, we were teenagers, and we kind of didn't really know what the rest of them looked like. Kind of had an image. And so we met them at the bus station, and there was my brother, Gar. And I'm, like I said, as a teenager, then I found out what happened to him. He'd been sent to a different foster home, but on the reserve. But I think they didn't understand that the people at the residential school, that kids have worries about all kinds of things. Like, I never knew what was going to happen to me when I grew up. I didn't know where I was going to live. They just told us when you're 16, you have to get out of here. That if it worried me, it probably worried everybody else. But anyway, life went on like that. So we learned to get the strap multiple times because, like I said, I couldn't always be quiet, and I was kind of a flighty little girl who got into mischief, I guess. But that's the way life was. So our meals, somebody asked me about the meals before. And yeah, we had porridge every day until towards the end. Then they gave us Cheerios on Sunday. And we put them in our pockets so we'd have something to eat later. And we never had snacks like they did by 1970. We'd put those little Cheerios in our pockets. If we found a string, we'd put them on so we'd have something to eat all day, munch on. Anyway, I hated spinach. Well, if they had maybe not cooked it, it wouldn't have been so bad, but they cooked it. It was all awful and gross, and you had to eat it. But we had tin plates and tin cups, so I would put my spinach, tamp it down in the bottom, and turn it over, and that lasted for a while until they figured out which plate it was, and because we sat in the same places all the time. And so when I remember sitting there one afternoon, almost the whole afternoon, because I couldn't eat that awful spinach. But I knew I had to at one point, so eventually I just kind of stuck it in my mouth and swallowed. But every time we had spinach after that, I would stick it in my potatoes and just swallow it whole, because I knew I was going to have to sit there. That's about the only thing that I didn't like. The porridge sometimes was kind of slimy, and because the older girls cooked it, and sometimes they cooked it too long. But if that's what you were going to eat, you ate it. I know my younger sister, Roberta, she says to me, a little friend beside her says, "You know, there's worms in this porridge." Rob says, "No, I don't think so." That girl said, "Well, what's that then?" And my sister, she tells me this later. She says, "Well, I just pushed it aside and ate the rest because that's what you were going to eat. I mean, if you didn't eat that, you weren't going to eat until maybe the next meal." So you do kind of crazy things like that. But the older girls used to have to set the table and dish out the food and stuff like that. And the staff table was right up the front so they could watch us. And we knew that they had better food than we did. They had cream for their coffee in the morning. And so I had an older friend who was supposed to look after me as a little girl. And she worked on that table. And I said to her one day, "Do you think you could take some of their cream and put it in my cup?" And actually, she did. So we had porridge, but we also had a slice of bread with jam. So one morning, I had the most delicious breakfast ever. I had cream in my cup. It never happened again, but that was just an awesome thing. Those are the things you remember, those good things that happened there. And so, like, life went on. Like, we were there from 1957 to 1961. We never went home. But we did have a couple of good times. I don't know if anybody knows where Christian Island is on... Anybody know where Christian Island is? Awesome place. In the summertime, they would send the kids that never went home. They'd send us up there because it was a reserve there. And it was just nice. We never got the strap there. The food was better. We got to swim every day in that beautiful water. Did arts and crafts. So summers, when we went up there, were really, really good. And then in the fall, we'd have to come back and come back to the mush hole. And so that was kind of like what our life was about. It was kind of more or less trying to fend for yourself and to be violent with each other. So if somebody had something that you wanted, and I didn't tend to do that, but I know that other kids would do that to me. If I had something and they wanted it, like every Christmas, we would get invited into Brantford at the Hotel Kirby. The guy would there, the owner, would put on this great, beautiful dinner for us and give us a little present, a little bag of candy, because we never got candy otherwise, and a big orange, because we never got oranges either. So that was a really special time. And I remember getting this little doll. It was just beautiful, clean, nice clothes on it. It looked just gorgeous. But another girl had... a little bit older than I was, she ripped her doll's arms off, poked out the eyes, and did all kinds of crazy stuff. I just wanted to keep that beautiful little doll for myself. Nope, that was the end of that. She took it, and I wasn't getting it back. I said, "But that's mine." She says, "No, it isn't. That was mine." You can't argue with those older girls. They're just going to do whatever, or they're going to hit you. So that was the end of my beautiful doll. And we never celebrated Easter. We didn't even celebrate birthdays. So I really didn't have any idea when my birthday was. So life went on like that until one day they said, you and your sister, Rob. Oh, I forgot to tell you what happened to my older sister. So Carol, she was a little bit feisty. She was feistier than me. I don't know what she did, but the minister wanted to, or he ran the school. He was the ultimate authority. He wanted to strap her in front of us and use her as an example. So he wanted to take her pants down and strap her on the bare butt. Well, she wasn't having any of that. You have to know my sister Carol. So she turns around and hoofs him and knocked him flying. So they sent her off to reform school saying she was unruly. I think she was just defending herself. I wouldn't like that to happen to me either. You know, like at that age, 12... it's kind of embarrassing. It's very personal. Anyway, so that's what happened to Carol. And I didn't see her again until I was in my 20s by then, because she'd been all over the place. But anyway, so one day they said one Christmas, they told my sister Rob and I, you're going to go somewhere for Christmas. We didn't have a choice. So they sent us off to this foster home north of Toronto. And Oh, it was really nice. Everybody was nice to us. We didn't get the strap. Nobody yelled at us. They gave us presents that we could keep over Christmas. I mean, keep forever, because nobody was going to take them away from us. And then they asked us, because we also went outside, and they had a nice big hill behind the house, so they had a sleigh, so we went tobogganing and stuff like that. It was just such a nice place for us compared to what we had. So they asked us if we wanted to stay, and of course we said, yeah, we want to stay. And I guess because we were Native, they had to ask the reserve at one point if they could adopt us, and they said, no, you can't. Anyway, so we didn't know that till later. Anyway, so Rob and I went there, and one day my sister Rob had something I wanted. I couldn't tell you what it was now. So what did I do to her? Punched her in the nose, gave her a bloody nose, and took it. And the foster mother looks at me and she says, what is wrong with you? How could you do that to your sister? It was totally foreign to her, but that was the environment that we lived in. And to me, everybody did that. And you're kind of looking at me a little weird, I can see that. But she picked up a chair once when I had a brush that she wanted and whacked me across the back and took the brush. She was a little stronger by then, and because she was a year younger than me, but she learned to be just as feisty and, you know, aggressive, because that's what we learned. But the other part was that we were going to a public school, and we were way behind. We didn't know how to spell, we didn't know how to read or do our math or anything, so my sister Rob and I, every single night, we would practice our facts, we'd practice our spelling. I learned to finally read in grade 5 through that public school. And so it took us, I think, until I was in grade 8 before I felt, even with my peers. So we also knew that we couldn't treat the people in the school the same way we treated each other or how the kids treated each other at the mush hole. You wouldn't have any friends. You know, if you decided to punch one of them in the face, plus you'd probably get kicked out of school. So we had to kind of adjust our attitudes, like, right away, which we did, and found it was much easier to live in that environment without the violence. But there were other things going on. So when we were little, like, I think I went there when I was 11 or 12, 11 maybe. Maybe 12. Anyway, so they treated us like little kids, and that was fun. We went outside and played. We worked hard. I learned to drive the tractor, standard. And we did all the baling of the hay and, you know, throwing it in the barn. But I put a stop at, I'm not doing the threshing machine stuff. That looked too dangerous for me. So I said, no, I don't think I want to do that. So they didn't make me. But anyway, so that's what we did. We slopped out the pigs every Saturday morning. Pigs are pretty stink. I know. But you get used to it. You do what you have to do. The food was always really good. She was a really good cook. She taught us how to cook as well. And, you know, to set a table and all of those other things. She was English. And she made us polish the silverware on Saturday morning. Because that's what she learned when she was a kid. Anyway, so that didn't hurt us. The hard work didn't hurt us either. We had lots of fun. They give us time to play in the woods sometimes or, you know, take the dog for a walk. And we only got lost a few times, but we made our way home eventually. Anyway, so one day, the routines were always the same. So one day when the foster father says to me, I need your help down on the 9th concession. I didn't think anything of it. I jumped in the truck and away we went. Don't know what he went there for, but on the way back, he reaches over and he puts his hand on my leg. And I knew that shouldn't happen. I said, take your hand off my leg. He says to me, why, what are you going to do? What are you going to do if I don't? I said, I'm going to jump out of this truck. I'm still a little feisty. And he didn't think I would, but I did. I jumped out of the truck, scraped up my whole leg, it got all infected. And I just found out recently on forensic files. You jump out of the truck, you can be killed doing that. Back then, I didn't know. So out I went. Anyway, so, but they didn't take me to the doctor, and that should have told me something as well. It would now. So nobody knew. My sister says, I remember when your leg was all infected, but she didn't know why I jumped out of the truck. my friend from another reserve, that was, she was also had come to that same foster home. She's about 2 weeks younger than I was, but we were friends at the mush hole. And then there was an older girl who was from the mush hole. She came. And then there was another two little ones that came. And so I think in total there were 9 of us in the same foster home. And you kind of wonder what the heck was going on. Why'd they put so many people in that home? But anyway, when I fell out of the truck, not fell, jumped, he stopped the truck and helped me up. And he said, "And don't tell mother." I didn't tell. I was so used to being told what I should do and shouldn't do, I thought I'd get in trouble. So I didn't tell. So then I see my friend Barb. Something happened to her in the kitchen one day when my back was turned. I heard her hit the floor. So I turned around and looked at her, and there she is lying on the floor, and she's kicking at the dad, that our foster father. I never asked her what happened. But one day she says to me, everybody was gone. We were told never to use the phone when everybody was gone. I would have listened. Barb didn't. She'd been in lots of foster homes. So she kind of knew what to do and who to call. I said, well, you know, Barb, we're not supposed to use the phone. Everybody's gone. She says, watch me. And back in those days, it was the old crank phone, you know, wind it up and get the operator. And so she did that. And we got hold of the children's aid lady. And I have to really commend that lady. She believed us right away. And she came out that very afternoon. Oh, and they had an older son who was in his 35, about 35 or 40, somewhere in there. He was kind of doing the same things, touching us inappropriately, saying it was an accident. But we knew it was no longer an accident. It might have been when we were little kids that, you know, if you're playing hide-and-go-seek and they want to play with us, it might have been an accident. But by the time we got to that age, like 13, 14, we knew it was no longer an accident. So when the children's aid lady came, she told them they had to get out of the house. And so they left and we got put in a different foster home. Oh, I forgot to... One more story from when we first went there. The foster mother said to me, when's your birthday? And I had said, well, July the 5th. Sounded like a good day at the time. And so I thought, well, nobody will know the difference. I'll just celebrate July the 5th. And so she must have got the paperwork shortly thereafter on us. And she looks at me and she says, you ninny, what made you think your birthday was July the 5th? Like, I'm an idiot, you know. But nobody ever told us when our birthday was. Nobody ever celebrated our birthdays. She says, your birthday's September the 27th. And I found out, I didn't really much care about how old I was. It wasn't important. But that's how I found out. And after that, they always celebrated our birthdays. And so eventually, well, we went to another foster home after that. And, like, we didn't really, nobody ever let us look after their kids. I don't know what they thought we were, but we couldn't really babysit or anything like that until we went to the next foster home. And I don't know what kind of paperwork they had on us that said we couldn't do things like that. But anyway, so we ended up babysitting here and there. And one day that new foster mother, she had 3 kids. And she says, we're going away next week. You're going to have to find a place to stay. Oh, okay. What are you going to do, Rob? She says, I don't know. I said, I can ask my friend Edith. I met her in high school, and we became really good friends. And I said, I'm going to ask Edith, see if her mother will let me come over for the week, which she did. But I was kind of concerned about my younger sister. She said, well, there's that German lady that I babysit for on the other side of town. I'll go ask her. And that lady was happy to have Rob because Rob really liked her because she always treated Rob really nice. And so, like, it's a different set of rules now for this new foster home. But we didn't stay with her very long either because that friend Barb that I had, she went to babysit for the summer near Pickering in a place called Greenwood. And so she wanted to go back home. So she said she was going to quit that job and not go to school there. She was going to go back to stay with her dad. So she said, but you'd like her. You should come here. So she was my best friend, still is. So I phoned up that lady and said, could we come there? And she said, sure. I said, well, my sister has to come with me. She had no problem with that. So both Rob and I went to this new foster home, and she was, I'm trying to see if there's any younger, really younger kids in here. She was different, very open-minded, but she had two boys and a little girl, and she was very tolerant, very understanding of teenagers and, you know, things that went on at that age. And so her boys would be always smoking up, doing drugs, LSD. I just found out recently that's acid from watching Forensic Files. Anyway, so those kids would be smoking up all the time, sometimes drinking, and the neighborhood kids would come and stay at her house too, sometimes for weeks. So one day I didn't understand. Well, they'd always ask my sister Rob and I, you want to smoke? Do you want to drink? Want some LSD? Both Rob and I always said no. Had that drilled into us at a very early age. Don't do that. You're going to look like this picture. There was this awful picture that they had for smokers. Must have held true because we wouldn't smoke or drink. Anyway, so one day I asked Gwen, that was our foster mother, and she was a single parent, and I said to her, Gwen, how come you let your boys smoke up in the house, even take in the neighbor's kids and let them stay? And she said, you know why? Because my two boys, if they're at your house or your house, I have no idea what's happening to them. If they get into trouble, if they need help, I want to know where my boys are so I can give them the help that they need if they need help. So I thought, what a wonderful attitude for that woman. She wasn't like anything else, like any other foster parent that we'd heard about or whatever. She was just so open-minded. She also taught me about that I could be who I wanted to be, that I could like the music I liked, and I didn't have to worry about, you know, somebody saying, oh, you like that stupid music or whatever. Mine was Bob Dylan, protest singer, Joan Baez, all those protest singers. They had awesome voices. I still like Bob Dylan. And so she showed us how to do art. She was a sculptor as well and tried to get us interested in that. But she was in an entirely different world than what we had been used to, that very regimented way. So, and I eventually finished high school, but although I didn't know that as a Native person that I had certain rights. I had never gone back to the reserve. I didn't go back there permanently until 2000, when I was 50 years old. Anyway, so I went back for a little bit, but I wasn't really accepted because even though my other family members were there, they didn't know who I was. So it was kind of like, what are you doing here? Who is your family? I never heard of you, you know, and because I dressed differently because I had lived in Toronto, and they said things like, oh, you think you're better than us. Well, I wasn't better than anybody. I was just trying to fit in. And so I eventually left. My sister Rob stayed. She eventually fit in, but she felt kind of like the same way. We didn't know our culture. We didn't know our language, but it wasn't important to me at the time. And so I eventually moved away, and I lived in Winnipeg first for a few years, and then I moved to Edmonton for a few years. I always had a good-paying job, so I could take care of myself because that was one of the things that we were told. When you're out of the CAS, you're 18, you're on your own. Well, I didn't know that I could have gone. I loved school. I absolutely loved high school. And if I had known that I could have gone on to college or someplace else, I would have. I liked school that much. So I didn't know that. So after I got homesick, because I was still not knowing any of my brothers and sisters, really, other than the one, Rob. And so one day I just quit my job in Edmonton and I moved home. And so I got to know some of my distant relatives, cousins, you know, aunts, uncles, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so I didn't have a job, so somebody said, you know, you could be a supply teacher back then. I think we only needed to have our grade 12, which I did. So I start supplying in one of the schools on the reserve, and the principal and one of the teachers said, have you ever thought about being a teacher? I go, oh, I could never do that. That's way too hard. No, I don't think I want to do anything like that. Well, why don't you? They're having an orientation for Native people at Lakehead. I didn't have anything else to do that summer, so I went. And everybody laughs when I say that because it was like it was an incidental thing that happened, and yet it was such a turning point in my life. Well, I got up there, and like it was in a Native class, for sure. They're all Ojibwe, except for me, a Mohawk. Anyway, I spent the summer there, and actually I spent most of my time trying to teach the other classmates English because they were so poor at it. So anyway, I went there, and then I spent two more years after that getting my degree. And so when I finished, I had a teaching certificate, and I had to get a few more credits to get my BA. But I could still teach, as long as it was on a reserve. But it was actually in a public school where I finally ended up. But I got my degree, my BA. And then a couple more years later, I got my BEd. And so then I became a teacher, and I absolutely loved it. And because I had taken Ojibwe, and all my classmates at the time were Ojibwe, it was easy to learn the language. So they would try to speak to me all the time in the community that I was in. They were also Ojibwe. They'd knock on my door and, you know, talk to me in Ojibwe, so it kind of reinforced it. And then I had to teach 1, 2, 3 for a couple of years. I had to teach the Ojibwe language because they knew it was on my transcript that I had taken it, which again helped to reinforce that language. So for 28 years, I was a teacher. I usually taught grade 8. Nobody likes grade 8. I love the grade 8 students. So I came home in 2000. And I think the reason I got the job was because nobody wanted that grade 8 class. So I flew home, moved home. I had a week to move home and start teaching here on the reserve because up north it was a public school. And the first year was really scary. The kids were very aggressive. They were. And I could see why nobody wanted that grade. But I didn't have another job, and I thought, I can't quit. I won't have another job. So I toughed it out for that year. And everybody said, you know why, you got the job. Nobody else wanted that. And I go, thanks a lot. But after that, all of the classes that I had, and so they stuck me. I didn't have actually, I only had primary junior qualifications. So when they hired me, I didn't have the qualifications for teaching grade 8. But I actually love teaching grade 8. There's so many things you can do with kids that age, and so they're more outspoken and challenging, you know, in their thinking and stuff like that. I just couldn't understand why nobody wanted those grades, and nobody ever challenged me to take that grade 8 class. So when I finally retired, I was still teaching grade 8. And I think that's one of the most rewarding things in my life, you know. I never did learn Mohawk, but I know my grandchildren do. They know how to speak. Because they teach it right from kindergarten all the way up to, and into the high schools too now, either Mohawk or Cayuga. So my oldest granddaughter, who's 22, she speaks it in the house. She tries to get those little ones to speak the Mohawk language. And just having hearing it all the time, I know that I've picked up some of that language. I still think in Ojibwe, though. But anyway, so that's basically my life. And I think the biggest impact for me was not being able to, not knowing that I could voice my opinion. I didn't know who I was. I was always floundering about what I was going to do with my life. I didn't know. I didn't know what I could be. Like we all teach, you know, kids now, what do you want to be when you grow up? Well, even in high school, if you want to be that, then you need to take this. You know, and we try to steer them into a certain direction if we can. But nobody ever tried to steer us. They just tried to make us into housekeepers and sewers and maids and stuff like that. Because originally, that's what, when the first mechanics school was put in 1828, they took 15 native kids and taught them a trade, which I guess was okay. But as time went on and the schools were built, they suspect that the older boys had burnt down two of them. And then the last one we have now, it's still up. And they're trying, you can, if you look behind the walls, you can see where some of that burnt timber is. They just built over it. So how many of you have been to the Brantford Residential School? Yeah, and they're renovating it, trying to restore it to what it was. Oh, so anyway, let you ask questions after, but one more thing. My sister, Rob, she's the feisty one, she started a group, of which I'm the secretary treasurer. She forced me into it. After we both retired, she became a registered nurse for 32 years, I think. She was nursing. I didn't go back to school till I was 35, and, well, I graduated and when I was 37. But she started this group. It's mostly residential school survivors or their descendants and a couple of community members. We're a corporation. We also have charity status. She decided to make something really positive of that area. Like on the girls' side, we're putting in a 5-acre park. So far, we've raised about $440,000. And we got a design company out of, I think it's Burlington or Mississauga somewhere, Cedar Springs, to design a park for us. So it's on a video on our site, which is, you put in www.mohawkvillagepark.com. It'll show the park. It'll show you who we are, some stories in there. But I think it's more that we're trying to make something positive out of something that was negative. It's, to me, our own type of reconciliation for us. But it's open to everybody. It's not just for the reserve or not just for Native people. It's for everybody who has the same mindset. So when I was in the playroom one day, I was feeling really sad. And so I laid down on the bench. Nobody ever hugged you. Nobody ever said you did anything well. Our mother wasn't capable of coming to see us or anything. She would have hugged us. She came a couple times. But we mostly didn't see her. And in that environment, that was very violent. So I was feeling really, really sad one day. Really depressed. I don't know how old I was. I just know I was a little girl. And so Miss Tawn came along. She asked me why I was crying. I couldn't tell her. Kids not that age don't tell. Anyway, and I wanted to tell her that, you know, I'm sad. Nobody ever hugs us. Nobody ever puts an arm on us or, you know, anything. So I didn't tell her. She eventually went away. And I cried myself to sleep. And this is why I came here today to tell this story. I forgot all about it. Anyway, so I cried myself to sleep. And I don't think I don't go to church, but the experience, I find I'm very spiritual, because when I fell asleep on that bench, I could see Jesus standing on the side over where the kitchen was. He was standing on top of that building, looking down at me on that bench. And he didn't really talk to me, but he sent me a message that said, I will always look after you. And that even wasn't the best part of the whole experience. I'm not saying I had a vision. I'm telling you I had a dream, a very vivid dream. It stays with me to this day. A whole wave, physical wave, went right through me. Started in my head, went right down through to my feet. But then it was a physical wave. I could feel it going right through my body. of peace and love and goodness. And I got off of that bench, and I knew that I didn't really have to worry about anything anymore, or that I knew who was going to look after me. And over my lifetime, I've had to come back to that more than once to realize that I've been helped. I've been helped in my life by Jesus. I know I had a minister one time, actually was a pastor, I guess. He said to me, and I was telling him about my story when I was up north, and he said to me, "Who are you that you think Jesus would come to you? Why would you be so special?" I go, "I have no idea. But hey, I'm not changing what I'm telling you because it happened." And I thought, what an awful thing to say to me. Like, when I had to think about it for a couple days. But by that time, he left town. Thank goodness. Anyway, so that was my experience. But my sister, the younger one, she was a year younger than me, Roberta. Hers was entirely different. And we grew up in the same environment, same foster homes. We didn't talk about this until we were in our late 50s. So I knew she was going for some kind of therapy or something or other. She'd go to Toronto every Saturday morning, and I don't know, I never asked her. It wasn't my business. So finally when she felt comfortable, I guess, enough to tell me, she said she'd been molested by Zimmerman, who was the head of the school. And she said when our mother came to visit, she was upset that our mother had to leave. And so she would cry and cry and cry because she really didn't want our mother to leave. And so the first time it happened, she said, Zimmerman took her into his office. Our mother had gone by then, and we had probably all gone back down to the playroom. And he started to fondle her. Eventually, he sexually assaulted her. And she said, I really didn't know what was going on. She just knew that it shouldn't be happening. And so eventually, like every Sunday morning, we dressed up, we went to church. And she said, I was so afraid to go to church because I knew he was the minister and he would see me there. And so she said the first time she didn't have to go, her nose started to bleed and they couldn't stop it. So she didn't have to go. She thought that was wonderful. She didn't have to go to church that Sunday. So somebody stayed behind with her. And so the following Sunday, she said, I didn't want to go to church. I did not want to have to face that man again. But she said, she started to punch herself in the nose. So her nose would bleed, but she couldn't get it to bleed. So she had to go to church. And in church, you could not fall asleep, no matter how little you were. And I swear those sermons dragged out for 50 years. I remember falling asleep, but, you know, I have a friend who might nudge me and wake me up. But Rob fell asleep. And so when she woke up, there's the minister staring right at her. And she was deathly afraid again. And so I think, because we all had to go back and sing, well, with a partner, we marched back to the residential school. She said he took her into a side room and molested her again. But she suppressed all that for years and years and years. Like I said, she didn't tell me, and we're the closest two in our family. She didn't tell me until she was in her late 50s. And, you know, she has a lot of anger, a lot of she was always a fighter, let's put it that way. She was always a fighter. She wouldn't put up with any crap from anybody, guys included. However, we both ended up with partners that were not the nicest, you know, and because we were kind of used, she said she didn't think she was worthy of anything more. She knew that this is the type of person that she was going to end up with. Me, when my partner was, he wasn't physically aggressive with me yet when I met him. But what I liked about him was that he wouldn't put up with any crap from anybody. The police were even afraid of him. So they let him roam, do his own thing and whatever, and I thought, there's an aggressive person that nobody's going to push around. But that didn't last long. I had a little girl with him. But one day I just said, this is not the kind of life I want. So I called my sister Rob, my other sister Marie, and said, I'm moving out today. Come and help me. They were there within a half an hour. Moved everything out. When my partner found me again, he says, you know, you wouldn't have left if I'd been home. And I said, that's why I left when you weren't home. When I was at work. But I'm not coming back. I'm not going to live my life that way. And to me, if you want to change anything in your life, you got to do it. Nothing, you can't blame it on somebody else that, you know, this is what happened, and because of this, I'm doing this. Not to me. And I've changed my life several times because I knew that I could. I wasn't going to put up with any nonsense from anybody. So here I am today. No nonsense. Anyway, those are my stories, and I was supposed to tell that one about Jesus.